Today we're going to be discussing Riemann surfaces, so we're going to move a little more to the geometry and temporarily away from topology for the moment, although topology will play an important role. So Riemann surfaces are a kind of beautiful and classic piece of geometry which you can treat using the language of Riemannian geometry, complex geometry, you can treat using algebraic geometry, it links into number theory. So it's a real central piece of many areas of mathematics. So I'm going to start by taking a perspective which is based on Riemannian geometry, just assuming that everybody is familiar with that. So from the perspective of Riemannian geometry, a Riemann surface is an oriented manifold of dimension 2 with a conformal class of metric. So what does this mean? Locally, if I take a metric G, well, G and e to the minus 2 phi G, where phi is a scalar field, are in the same conformal class. So the transformation where G gets sent to e to the minus 2 phi of G is called a Vail rescaling, or Vail transformation. So have you guys seen this notion before in... No? Yeah, some people have. Well, if anybody's taken CFT, it's an important notion in CFT because conformal field theory is a quantum field theory which doesn't depend on G, but only depends on G up to Vail transformations. So that means it acquires extra symmetry beyond the symmetries with the Lorentz symmetries. And it's an important notion in string theory because in string theory, the string world sheet is equipped with a conformal class of metric. So one can study conformal geometry in any dimension, but in dimension 2, it's really nice. The following reason.
Kevin, what is the difference between, like in CFT, we studied conformal transformation with the same definition, and now we are saying it's called a Vail transformation.
I would have said a conformal transformation was a change of coordinates, which sends the metric to a rescaling of the metric. And here I'm not changing the coordinates, I'm just multiplying the metric by a function. But Vail transformation is a very fancy name for something really stupid. I multiply the tensor by a scalar.
So but all the conformal transformations are a subset here, or It's because I understand there you're making a space-time transformation which is inducing this.
So maybe I could say, so a conformal transformation is the analog of an isometry in this geometry. So it's a map, it's a coordinate change. Where G transforms to e to the minus 2 phi G for some phi. So for instance, if we start with the flat metric, dx squared plus dy squared, sending x to 10 times x, y to 10 times y, is a conformal transformation. But is not an isometry, because I've changed. So conformal transformations, more generally, we'll do more of them in a minute. Like anytime you make a map of the Earth, you draw the Earth on a page, that's a conformal transformation because it, in two dimensions, as we will see, transformation is conformal if it preserves the concept of being orthogonal. It might change the lengths of everything, but if I have two orthogonal vectors and they stay orthogonal, that's a conformal transformation.
These two metrics are in the same class. You mean like the Earth's hemisphere is same as the flat map we have? They are same.
Yeah, a patch of the Earth's hemisphere is the same as a.
We're just classifying different manifold to say they are same thing, right?
Well, it's
because we could define without this class of relation, like without these relations.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of different levels of refinement, right? So the coarsest one is just topology. And then, then there's really no local structure. So, and the finest one would be, say, Riemannian geometry, and you're able to measure length. This is just a kind of an intermediate structure between the two. So it seems a little funny now because we've defined it by saying we start with the Riemannian metric and then we throw away the information of the overall scale. But there is a way to define it. An alternative way to define it, which is more intrinsic, I want to get to in a minute. Maybe this is a useful fact. Special to two dimensions, in 2D, every metric is locally equivalent to locally formally equivalent to the flat metric. So this is, if you study general relativity, you might know that this is false in dimension 4. Generally, dimensions bigger than 2, because the Vail curvature tensor only depends on the conformal class of the metric. That is, if you're working in dimension 4 like you would with ordinary general relativity, the Vail curvature tensor is some components of the Riemann curvature tensor. And there are some components that just don't change if I scale the metric.
Can you explain
this problem? When I said it was false in dimension 4?
Yeah.
Right, so in dimension four, there's some components of the Ricci curvature tensor such that if I apply this transformation to the metric, they don't change. Now, you can find a metric where those components are not zero. So that means it is just not the same as the flat metric. Because in the flat metric, those components are zero. However, the reason it's true in dimension two is there really isn't very much you can say about curvature in dimension two. The curvature is the scalar curvature. S, the scalar curvature of, there's a formula for how this transforms, which I got from Wikipedia, which Wikipedia hopefully got from a good book. So basically, I add to S the Laplacian, my scalar field. So that means if I can find phi and phi so that this equation is satisfied. Actually, I think this was actually a minus. Then we can set S to zero. And locally, we can always do this. This is, I don't want to go into too much detail about this point. If maybe we could take this fact as a black box, and this is just a hint of one possible argument. The way you would do it is you get yourself to this PDE, ask your friendly analyst who would tell you that this PDE is always has a solution. Any questions? Okay. Let's move now to the alternative way of defining conformal geometry. If sigma has a conformal class of metric, and is oriented, for each point in sigma, define map J TP sigma to TP sigma by J of V is a vector obtained by rotate V counterclockwise by 90 degrees. So there's my V, will be J of V. Yep. If I have a metric, there's certainly nothing stopping me doing that. It might help to write it a little more formally. I.e., J of V is the unique vector So it has to be orthogonal. Must be the same length. As V and V JV form an oriented basis. This is where we need an orientation. Now, if you think about it, this only depends on the metric up to scale. Because if I multiply g by a constant everywhere, the equations don't change. Because g is, here is the same degree in each equation. So that implies, so J only depends on the conformal class. Also, you notice that J squared is minus the identity. It's because if I rotate to 90 degrees twice, then the vector to minus itself. Yeah.
Seems like C could be negative here, but for the conformal class, it has to be positive.
Oh, I can. Let me put it like that. The conformal class is only positive because just because we want to restrict to the Riemannian metric, pseudo Riemannian. The nice thing is that the converse is true. So if you give me such a J on every tangent space, your way of rotating by 90 degrees, that's the same thing as a conformal tacit metric. So if, for all points in sigma, we define a linear operator like this, j squared equals minus 1, which varies smoothly, then this is the same thing, a conformal tacit metric. So the point is, so what we're saying is that the metric has starts life as having three components. We get rid of them by one of them by a veil rescaling. We're left with two components. And these two components are encoded precisely in this matrix. So proof. So how will we construct the metric from J? Let's choose a vector field. Let's just choose coordinates. And then we define this makes sense because del x and j del x are a frame. So, I mean, the only thing we've really chosen is this, is a vector field, which I've called del x. I've decided to normalize that to 1. Well, the only choices in this coordinate, and if I change my normalization of del x, I'm going to change the metric by a veil transform. This way of encoding the conformal geometry tells us more easily when does a transformation preserve the conformal geometry? And the answer is if it preserves the operator J. So, since the operator J is encoded in the concept of being orthogonal, it preserves orientation, not strictly necessary, and orthogonality. Let's do some examples. Unless there's any questions. So the first example was something Giuseppe. Oh, yes.
Where did we use J2 is equal to minus identity? Did we use that? Right.
Let's see. I think you would use that if you wanted to. Like the thing that the point we didn't check was like, you know, at each point I chose a direction. I call del x, and I normalize that to be 1. And I wanted to you want to show that the metric is independent of that choice.
Maybe the independency of del x, dx and jdx, maybe this needs j2 equals minus jd. If we want to say these two are independent, I think we need to use that.
I mean, the independence between del x and j del x can happen even if j squared is not minus the identity. Just think about rotating a small amount. But suppose j didn't rotate all the way through 90 degrees, but just a small amount. then we're doing something funny where I mean, here's the way we'd use it. Suppose I started with J del X, and then I ran through those definitions, and you want to get the same metric. Then in the second line, it would be J del X, J squared del X. And you want that to be the same equation. So you need J squared as minus one.
So the existence of this G depends on that condition, right?
I think I can always write down a formula like this and it will define a G. Hold on, I'm a little bit confused. If we took a J which didn't satisfy that equation, we wrote down such a G, then J could not be rotation through 90 degrees. Because that always squares to minus one. That's one way to say it. Okay, so okay if I move on to give an example? So Giuseppe actually wrote this example down ages ago. What was it called? A stereographic projection. Let me comment that, as I mentioned at the beginning, like this is this fact that the conformal geometry is the same thing as the concept of orthogonality is why like any map you have is a conformal transformation. Because it always preserves the orthogonality between lines of latitude and longitude. But no map can be an isometry because the two sphere is curved and the plane is not curved. So stereographic projection might be true with this little plane through the middle, which is kind of hard to draw. I take a point in the North Pole. I start with the North Pole and I take some other point and I draw a straight line until it hits the plane. P, and this is SP. Now, SP, sending P to SP preserves orthogonality. So Giuseppe had this lovely animation, which demonstrated that. We can see it. If you think about orthogonal lines on S2 are sent to here's my plane. That's the origin, like SP. So some of them are sent as straight radial lines, like that, and others are sent as circles. And these are still orthogonal. Let's use some other simple examples. I take the plane minus the origin, m, as metric. Is conformally equivalent to the cylinder. Because if I take the cylinder like this, all this coordinate x, coordinate theta, this maps to the plane. Or is e to the x, and theta is theta. The orthogonal lines on the cylinder get sent in an obvious way, the orthogonal lines on the plane. So that preserves the concept of orthogonality. Let me give you one more example. I didn't actually prepare that many examples of this kind of thing. This is the same kind of thing. The transformation from the plane minus the origin. To itself, which sends or theta goes to 1 over or minus theta, preserves orientation and conformal structure. So let's the thing we really wanted to get to,
For orthogonality, we need like an inner product, right? We have to.
Well, only up to scale, though, right?
Okay.
So if I have. I have an inner product, and you can define x, y as a number.
Yeah, so we just can use this definition, like, or this characteristic, just for like manifolds or like spaces with inner product, right?
Yes, because like a manifold, you have an inner product in each tangent space. But the point we're using is that the equation, the set of pairs of vectors which satisfy x, y equals 0, this equation doesn't change. If you scale the product.
Yeah, but I thought maybe for the notion of distance, we might have like a norm instead of inner product.
But it's really the same thing, just because the norm is the inner product of that vector with itself.
Yeah, we can just define norm as a general thing without inner product, right?
Oh, you mean like, yes, you can. You can think about like a metric. That's true. No, I don't know how to discuss the concept of conformal geometry if we started with some other concept of metric. I mean, if we start with the Riemannian metric, then you have an inner product. Yeah, maybe because you guys, like physics audience, another way to think about it is the conformal geometry, what it does is it tells you the null cone at every point. if you were in Euclidean signature, that's not a good definition, because there are no null vectors. But in Lorentzian signature, if you have the conformal passive metric, then at every point you can look for those vectors of lambda 0. That doesn't change if I scale the metric. So at each point inside of the tangent space, you have a null cone. And that's equivalent to conformal geometry. So in Lorentzian signature, it's telling you which direction light rays point. But that's it. The other nice thing about Riemann surfaces is that they have an interpretation in terms of complex geometry. Let's discuss how to get from there from the operator J. So J acts on the tangent space. And so it acts on every space of tensors. Better the joule. Or the transpose. So if in coordinates, J del x is del y, and J del Y is minus del X, then I'm going to act on the co-vectors kind of the opposite way. So making it act on co-vectors also makes it act on one form. So it's some linear operator on the space of one forms. So what we'd like to do is look for the eigenspaces.
So this J now is, you're saying, the transpose of the J here.
Yeah, which is the natural thing to do because these are dual vectors. Yeah. We're going to want to look for the eigenspace. Mm-hmm. So this is funny because J squared is minus 1. So any matrix which squares to minus 1 must have imaginary eigenvalues. The eigenvalues must also satisfy the equation x squared is minus 1. The eigenvalues, J, are plus or minus I. So therefore, the eigenvectors must have complex coefficients. Now, to understand this, we'll take omega 1 sigma c. These are one forms with complex coefficients. And we let omega 1, 0 be, let me check, plus r minus eigenspace, yeah, be the plus I eigenspace of J. Omega 0, 1. Be the minus I eigenspace of J. So this is seems like a funny thing, but let's check what it looks like in coordinates.
What does this notation mean? Omega 1, comma 0, and 0, comma 1.
That's the definition. These are subspaces of one forms.
Okay.
This is the vector space of one form satisfying.
Okay. Just the definition.
Yeah. So in coordinates, I should quickly remind you a fact we haven't used yet. Since G is locally conformally flat, J, I can always work in a patch where G is, looks like the flat metric, and then J looks like what I get from fat space. You can always find coordinates so that j del x del y, j del y is minus del x. And then a on a one form, I take j times f dx plus g dy. Is minus f y plus g dx, because it's the transpose matrix. So to find the 1-0 forms, we need to find the plus I eigenspaces. That equation is easy to solve. Omega 1-0 is things like f times dx plus I dy, because j of f dx I dy is f of minus dy plus dx. IDX. That's the plus I eigenspace. The minus I eigenspace is F times EX minus I.
It should be I out of F, right, in the right hand side. You factor I, the eigenvalue part, right?
No, I've multiplied it by I, you see. I've hit.
J of dx is minus dx, j of I dy is I dy. So there should be an I somewhere.
J of dx is minus dy.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
So for this, it seems that f is linear or something. We have already taken the j inside or something like that.
Yeah, well, j acts in each tangent space.
Okay.
It doesn't have any derivatives in it, so it just, the f just moves past the j.
Yeah, okay.
So you notice, let's see, if we set dz, the x plus I dy, then plus I eigenspace is f things like f dz minus I eigenspace is things like f dz bar. slightly off topic, but just a quick comment about Lorentzian signature. If we started with a metric which was Lorentzian, then you wouldn't have these factors of I. And you would find that the plus, we plus one and minus one eigenspaces, you wouldn't have factors of I basically because we're Rick rotating and setting y goes to it. And the, in that case, the eigenspaces are just the two null directions that you find in a Lorentzian manifold of dimension two. There's two light rays. These guys become null.
Because I thought we got the I's from the fact that J squared is minus identity.
Yes. Well, you have to redefine J in Lorentzian signature. So the concept of rotation through 90 degrees doesn't really work. Because if you take a vector, it can be orthogonal to itself. Oh, man. Yeah, so that part of it I'm finding myself a bit confused by. But the thing that is just true is that if you do the, if you do this procedure in Euclidean signature and then Rick rotate, these become null vectors. Which you can see because we're starting with the metric where this dx squared plus dy squared, then dx plus idy is null. The point of this procedure is, you see, I introduce a complex coordinate z, and we notice that j squared was minus 1. That should remind you of the fact that I squared is minus 1. So what's happening is, the choice of j is going to, by this procedure, allows us to talk about holomorphic functions on a patch. J gives us a version of the Cauchy-Riemann equations, which will allow us to do complex geometry. So on a patch, or it's on a surface, if I take F is a zero form with complex coefficients, we define E bar of F to be, we'll write it like this, minus 1 over 2i j 2i, let's say minus I, EF. And what's this? This is the projection onto one of the eigenspaces. Because if I take the piece that was in the plus I eigenspace, I get 0. And in the minus I eigenspace, I get 1. And similarly, this is a projection to the plus I eigenspace. So this is a 0-1 form. This is a 1-0 form. And we've set it up so that d of f is del f plus del bar of f. We've decomposed that a RAM operator is a sum of two points. So now our Cauchy-Riemann equation is going to be that this piece of vanishes. Holomorphic. If d bar of f equals 0. So in coordinates, m d of f is dx del x f plus dy del y f. Let's apply this operator to do it. D bar of f is minus 1 over 2i while dx gets sent to minus dy minus I minus I Let's stand this out. Well, if you work it out, looks like this. If you just collect the terms, you find each derivative of f is multiplied by dx minus I dy. So it looks like this kind of thing. So now, what we wanted the Cauchy-Riemann equations to be was that d bar of f is 0. We're finding in coordinates, these are the Cauchy-Riemann equations. So what we're seeing is that a Riemann surface gives you the structure to talk about holomorphic functions. We could even do a little bit better.
Yeah? The usual Cauchy-Riemann equations are something saying that we equate the imaginary and real part separately to zero or something. The usual form is like dy is minus dxf or something, and then something like that, right?
Yes. I mean, f is a complex valued function. Mm-hmm. So this is a.
Okay.
Since f is a complex valued function, this is both the real and imaginary parts of f.
Okay.
So it'll be dy of real part of f plus dx of the imaginary part.
Yeah.
slightly confused. I thought being holomorphic and satisfying the Cauchy-Riemann equations were different notions. Like, holomorphic is that it's complex differentiable, but holomorphic might not have a partial derivative or something.
I think it depends how. Depends how it's taught and how you learn it.
I think I was taught that they were equivalent, and then I mentioned that to Giuseppe, and he said there's actually counterexamples where you can be holomorphic but not satisfy Cauchy-Riemann or something. So maybe we're just taking this as the definition here.
Yeah, for me, like how the definition of holomorphic is always that it's a Cauchy-Riemann. And nothing bad can happen because this is, you know, if you have a very strong PDE, all solutions must be very nice functions. This happens with this equation. But there's no like nasty functions in this equation. Okay, so the other thing we can do once we have the question, once we know of this concept of the Cauchy-Riemann equations is that we can always find coordinates which map to C instead of R2. That is, we can always find coordinates which are holomorphic functions. On a surface, there always exists local chords x and y so that z, which is x plus I y, is a holomorphic function. But this is easy to see, but we already know this. Since G is locally conformally flat, it's kind of obvious because we just choose the coordinates where J looks like J dx is del y and J del y is minus dx. So once we have this, we also know we find these nice holomorphic coordinates, and the transition function between patches is also holomorphic. What we found from the end of the story, so is that Riemann surface has several different ways of describing it. Metric up to Weyl transformation. Okay, a 3 as something locally model on C, with holomorphic. Transition function. So I gave Giuseppe the notes. I have to end now, but we're going to pick up again at 3:45 today. So sorry, that's a little awkward. It's just like a makeup lecture for the retreat we had. So I will discuss. It's a pity I didn't get to do too many examples, but this afternoon I'll spend time doing a bunch of examples from this perspective, holomorphic geometry.
So, just to get in the string theory course, we are learning that the world sheet, you impose a complex structure on it.
Yes.
The part three, the way we did it is like any world sheet will be a Riemann surface. And you can impose. This is what the complex structure is.
Exactly. So a mathematician would say a complex, you know, you would read a math textbook, you would find either two or three to be the definition of complex structure, and then they would prove they're equivalent.